Sounds good.
Welcome to this episode of Pages and Panels. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kyle. My other co-host, Tim Medora, could not be here today, which is really disappointing because we actually had scheduled finally to talk about an episode of George Lopez's show, but he couldn't make it. So we're not going to be able to talk about the episode of George Lopez, where, much to George's unpleasant surprise, Angie and his family thrown in a belated birthday surprise party for him, and he assumes it's Mac's birthday party while a new worker, accident-prone Amy, played by Sandra Bullock, I don't know why she was on the George Lopez show, threatens the pride of George, where he takes in his safety record at the workplace. But so we're not going to be able to talk about that episode, which would normally be pretty upsetting, but we have maybe the only thing that would be better than that episode of George Lopez. I am really excited. We're going to be talking about the graphic novel Sparks, and to do so, joined by the creative team of Ian Boothby, Nina Matsumoto, and David Dedrick. How are you guys doing?
Very good.
Good. I think
as well as I can be.
Yeah, nice. All right. Yeah, there's all the, you know, the awful stuff, but
there's stuff, but you know, we're being productive. We're doing good. We're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, yes. I mean, I guess since, I mean, you all are obviously creators, and I know David and Ian, and then I know Nina dabbles in podcasting at times. Like, it's like, if there's like a one positive, like, is more time for creating and podcast. Like, we were like always like, all right, we got to get these episodes lined up. And then, like, when COVID hit, I was like, well, all these people want to do episodes. Like, I don't have time to do all these episodes now.
Yeah, talk to us. We're bored. We have nothing else to do. Please.
So I'm very excited. Sparks is a book I really enjoy. It is one, obviously, as a huge comic fan, you know, we do this show every week with books, you know, Image, Dark Horse, all of that. And there are books that I generally read. Occasionally, my wife will read books with me, but with two young kids, well, now I guess three in the house, reading comics with them has been something I've really enjoyed. And they've occasionally read, like, I don't know, get them, like, Miss Marvel or something, but we've kind of skewed now that he can, my oldest can actually like read on his own. He's been going to the store and picking out books on his own. And one of the first books he picked up was Sparks. And he read it that day, first sitting. I read it with him again, and we've read it a bunch. And then he was super excited when the sequel came out. We got it that week, and he read it that day, that night. So this one's exciting for me because I love just talking about comic books, and I'm super interested in general in the like young adult kids graphic novel I think market and book, because I think for where the industry is currently, I think that is like not only the future, but I think we need to focus more on that and kind of utilize that in a way to not see the adult one kind of die, which has been an interesting thing, especially with COVID currently. So again, I appreciate you guys coming on to talk about the book. Normally I would avoid, because it's like such an interviewee question, like how did this book come about, but occasionally I think either like I've done, like there'll be like a topic of a book which is really like a weird wacky topic, or there's one like this where I'm kind of interested in general, like how does a book like Sparks come about, especially with the three of you teaming up and then kind of teaming up with Scholastic, which if anyone doesn't know, I know we've referenced it a bunch on the podcast, but like people think about the big two in comics, like DC and Marvel, they are like pittance to what Scholastic actually is in the comic market. Like they they are the juggernaut, which is crazy. And I wish like they would take more notice of that, like, cause there's so many good things coming out from that. So like, how does a book like Sparks, like a general idea like that, come, and then you all three of you kind of team up to create that book? Like, how did that start?
Well, it originated as a failed animation pitch. I was pitching a completely different project called Baby Head, about a baby that swapped heads with people, and that was rejected, as it should have been. And and then we had a lot more time in the room So I started pitching this idea of two cats who would dress up as a dog and be the greatest dog hero in the world. And the name that we came up with, by we, I mean me, was Crewing the Pooch. And it was... And as things progressed, as we, of course, they said no, and again, rightfully so. And then I was pitching ideas to Scholastic after it stopped working for Bongo, where I Bongo Comics, who do Simpsons and Futurama, and that's where I kind of met Nina. And how we knew that they were actually interested was when they told us, you gotta change the name. And it's like, yeah, because it's a very dirty name. You're absolutely right. And once they did that, we were kind of up and running, and we called it Unleashed. And then they went, oh, no, we can't do Unleashed. Why? Because our biggest book is coming out is a Dogman book, and it's called Dogman Unleashed. And we're, oh, okay. And so, yeah, we came up with Sparks, and that was the start of it.
Yeah, Ian and I worked for Bongo Comics for a long time. Well, he worked on it a lot longer than I did. I was more of a latecomer, but I was a penciler for Bongo Comics, and he was a writer, and we collaborated on a few things. Like, with Bongo Comics, they just team you up, you know? Like, so they would give me his script, and then I would draw it. And there were, you know, tons of writers I quote-unquote worked with who I never actually met, because all I did was, like, you know, hand in the artwork for it. But in the case of Ian, since we had won an Eisner together for Murder, He Wrote, I was like, well, I should probably meet him at some point, especially since we both live in Vancouver. And it took us a while, but we finally met up.
Yeah.
And we got along, and we worked on, like, a couple more pitches for, like, a different comic after that. Nothing got picked up. And then he approached me with the idea for Crewing the Pooch, the cartoon series. And he said, oh, we just want you to do like the initial designs for it, to put together a design document as a pitch. And I said, okay, as long as all I have to do is do the design work for it. So I did that. And then later it got picked up as a comic book. And he was like, okay, this is a comic now. I'm like, what? Okay. I have to do a comic now, I guess. Well, it's not like he forced my hand, but since I was the one who designed the characters, and I mean, I've done some comics myself too, like outside of Simpsons comics, and it's been a long time since I did my original work, I was on board with doing this book for Scholastic, and now here we are. We're on our third book now.
Yeah,
that we're working on right now.
When I did approach Nina to do the images for the TV pitch, I made it though that we would both own this property, because, and I hate saying it's a property, but it's a property, because, you know, she's putting all this work in on it, she should have half of it. So when I sold it to, or was on the process of selling it to Scholastic, it just made sense for Nina, who's also a brilliant comic book artist, to do it. Otherwise we would have had to pay someone else, and, you know, we don't want to
yeah.
do that.
And yeah. I was totally down for it, yeah. despite the fact that I've always been bad at drawing animals, and especially cats. I've always had a problem drawing cats, which is why they're so stylized. I'm like, well, if I make them blobby and really weird, then it doesn't matter if they're anatomically incorrect, because it's a cartoon. It's okay. It'll mask the fact that I don't know how to draw cats.
There's actually a fun thing. Sorry, and Dave does exist, and you should talk to him at some point.
We'll get to him eventually.
Eventually, yeah. when Nina and I sometimes go and do talks at schools, one of the things that she does is she'll get kids to just draw any random shape on a board, and now this is a cat, and she'll just turn it and make it into a cat, because cats can be any, you know, crazy shape that you want. That's a nice thing about them.
Yeah, I just never really grew up with cats. I'm mostly a dog person. Ooh, that's another thing you can expose me on, by the way. The fact that I'm not a cat person at all. But hey, you know, this book is good for both. It's good for right. people who like cats and dogs.
Yeah, Charles Schulz wasn't, and he did okay.
He wasn't a dog person?
No, he wasn't a cat person. He tried drawing
oh,
cats
okay.
and drew them horribly. Like the Frida, I think was her name. She had a
yep,
cat in a couple of strips, and it's the most horribly drawn cat you've ever seen.
Well, yeah, I mean, Snoopy's not a perfectly drawn dog either.
That's
he was
true.
Originally,
well,
he looked okay
yeah.
originally,
yeah.
and then mutated into this World War One, PTSD, shell shocked, Joe Cool freak. Yeah, but people love him. So
yeah,
what are you gonna do?
Snoopy and Garfield both started off as like, you know, more anatomically correct cat and dog, and then eventually became more humanoid. So as the more Sparks goes on, the more they're gonna look like that. I think we're just gonna stand on their feet.
Good.
You think that's good?
No. I was just trying to be supportive.
Well, it's like the one, there's that one like sketch, I think, where it's like the like profiler sketch of Sparks. I think it's on the TV, and it's like a very like realistic dog sketch.
That's right.
Oh yeah, if I had my way, the entire book would be drawn like that, but no, has to be for kids. I will say, like, the reason why I don't color the book, like, I mean, I pencil it, I ink it, I do the lettering, but I don't do coloring because I'm better at black and white art, I think. That's more my style. I grew up with manga, and that's always black and white. So that's really more what I'm used to. And when I have to color my comic for anything, I'm just like, I don't want to do this. Like, I can't imagine my stuff in color. And so we had to hire a colorist, and that's where David came in.
That's true. That's where I came in.
And this is...
Sorry.
Oh, good. And I mean, for you, this is like... Is it like your second book you had colored?
Yes. Sparks was my first book I colored. Sparks 2 is the second book I colored. It's pretty limited range. But yeah, it's... I came in, and I guess Nina had asked someone else to do it before me.
Yeah, one of my friends who is a professional colorist.
Yeah, and so when I came in, I kind of came in with the idea that I was supposed to kind of continue in the style that this person had brought to it. And so I kind of started off that way, and then I sent some of the pages to Nina, and she was kind of like, shrug, or she sent me a meh face or something.
I didn't do that. This is Emoji Movie. Had to send the perfect meh face to you.
You sent me a poo emoji. And I went, oh, well, maybe I can make it more like what I want to do. So then I scrapped like the pages I'd done, and I started all over again. And I kind of just built it off the fact that there's a yellow and purple dog and a green, a kind of turquoise, you know, cat, and a blue and white cat. And I just thought, well, let's just make it really colorful and crazy. So that's kind of...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, my friend who's a colorist, her style is more gearing towards realistic colors because she tends to color more realistic stuff.
Yeah.
And when she did, like, the sample pages for me, and ultimately we couldn't work with her anyway because she was too busy, I did give the sample pages to David, but I wanted to make it clear that that's not the direction I wanted to go because, okay. Yeah, like you said, like, look at the main characters. Like, I had chosen the colors for the main characters before we hired David, by the way. And I really like cartoons that use unconventional colors. Like, I don't want a tree with, like, a brown trunk and green leaves. I want, like, a purple trunk and, like, turquoise leaves. Like, colors like that. Mm-hmm. And I especially like when the pupils, not the pupils, the whites of the eyes are not white. I kind of took that cue from the short-lived series Mission Hill, because they all have yellow eyes. And if you look at that show, like, the colors are just so interesting. I wanted a comic for kids that looked kind of like that. So that's kind of the direction I gave David, I think. I said to take cues from the characters themselves. And I think I gave a few more examples of coloring I liked. Like, for example, the Hilda series. I really like the colors in that.
Oh, yeah.
That so good.
They're a bit more muted than what we've done.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the story. Because you like Mission Hill and you kind of inspired, now Mission Hill's coming back because of Sparks.
That's right. Apparently. All thanks to us. Yep.
Her promotion.
Yeah, everyone read Sparks and thought, whatever happened to Mission Hill? I want to see more of that.
And I do think it's interesting that all three of us, Ian, Nina, and I, all come kind of from different comic traditions, I think.
Like, oh, definitely. Approach. We all like, we all have different tastes in comics, for sure.
Like, I'm not interested really in superheroes or know much about them at all. I'm more an Archie Richie Rich sort of a background, you know, for like in terms of color and stuff. So I much prefer like very like simple, solid colors and, you know, very, you know, just a lot of flat colors on a page. That to me is
and European comics too.
Yeah, you like your Belgian. You like your Belgian boy reporter comics.
Well, I love all kinds of Franco-Belgian comics, but Tintin is the jewel in the crown.
And that's, I think that's interesting too. Even, I mean, kind of the concept of it being early on a pitch for a animated series, because it very much feels like a animated series brought to the page. But like you said, kind of all of your styles, like Ian, your other comic work, and then even kind of like the actual like comedian work, and then Nina's other comic work is insane. I mean, you guys referenced it. So it's a Treehouse of 14, I think, number 14.
Yeah, it was number 14.
Yeah, that is easily one of like the craziest comic books that exist. I mean, the like level of talent on there to begin with, like it's like Steve Niles, I think Glenn Fabry, and then Gilbert Hernandez. But like your ability to actually like morph them into, like, I think you come the closest to making like the Simpsons look human-esque. Like that is maybe like you might have cracked Marge, I think. Like looking like a normal person. But then like everything else, like I loved a lot of the other stuff, because it's very like, again, either manga focused or kind of like very like indie like slice of life stuff. And then like you said with Diedrich, so like you guys kind of coming together with all of that, it seems like it blends very well, and you guys are able to kind of adapt all of that into this story, because again, it is very humorous, it's funny. I think the action for, again, a young adult kids book is like really good. It's well paced. Like I think it's it actually like follows really well. Like there's no like weird like cuts, or you guys don't like give a lot of I think concessions. Like I think everything flows and makes sense well. And then I think the colors are fantastic. Like to know this is like one of your like first times really coloring a book is crazy, because I think it is like, again, works very well and flows and like does a great job of kind of creating a lot of like silhouettes to draw the eyes. I think you guys like hit it out of the park with it. Is that something you guys coming from different mediums or different versions or tones of the mediums, but then adapting it to this very specific kind of like all ages focused like humor book? Was that something you had to adjust to a lot, or was it something that you were able to just kind of take your style and it kind of blended well easily?
I think for me, I just wanted to write something that I found was funny, which is really what I did with The Simpsons as well. And then, you know, I love working with Nina. I like getting her ideas on things, even more so in the latter Sparks books. But I think one of the advantages, and I don't know if this was the case with Dave, but like I don't read a lot of kids' comics. Like the Scholastic books that were out, I was very unaware of what was on the market.
Me neither.
With the exception of maybe a book like Smile or something like that.
Oh yeah, Raina's stuff. I read her stuff. That's it.
Yeah, I'd pick that up. But for the most part, no idea. So it was just, okay, I'm just trying to make a story that would make me laugh and make Nina laugh. And let's see where we go. And I always, when people ask, you know, what age range this is for, I'm just, anyone. That's it. That's what I write it for. I never, you know, I don't make the words too long, and don't pad it too much. But for the most part, I just try to make it as funny as possible and go from there and hope for the best.
But it also doesn't look down on the reader, I don't think.
Yeah, because kids can tell. I mean, again, when I was a kid, I loved Peanuts, and Peanuts would like quote Bible verse, you know, and do Beethoven jokes, and yeah, World War One flying ace stuff, and really get into, you know, him like in a bar in France missing a girl he loved back home. And it's like, well, that's in no way for kids, and that's the kind of stuff that I wanted when I was a kid, was not the stuff that was for kids.
And I grew up in Calvin and Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's also very I don't know how to say it. It kind of opens up a world to you that you can explore if you're a kid. If you're interested in following the trail the authors leave, you can expand your knowledge, you know, or just feel like a smarty pants for reading it. You have both options.
So I guess none of us really read kids' comics.
Well, Dave is the only parent of among us. Did your kids read kids' comics when they were?
No, not really. I think by the time I never really, there wasn't like a strong graphic novel presence with Scholastic when the girls were younger. The only thing being close to that would be like Captain Underpants or something. There wasn't like a lot of, I think that's kind of a new part of their what they're doing. And when I started, and it's true, when I started doing the color for Sparks, I actually went and looked, because I was so kind of at sea when I started, I went and looked at some graphics, like kids' books at a local bookstore. I just went and kind of paged through them just to see what the color was like. And I found that really dark and kind of gloomy. And I was thinking, well, this isn't really for kids. Like, you're not, like, all the pages seem very heavily shadowed. And this is not all of them, but the ones I was looking at, it just felt like it just didn't appeal to me. And it's part of when I was a kid, I remember reading, getting like a copy of Spider-Man, because I was really interested in the concept of Spider-Man. And so I picked up this comic, which was the Molten Man issue. I don't know when it came out, but, and it was so dark and muddy feeling. It was really like repulsive to me as a kid. Like, I like put it aside, and I was never interested in superhero books after that. And so, you know, when I was looking at these, I was thinking like, well, what is appealing about this to kids? Like, why would they want to read something where it's kind of soupy and a lot of sepia and brown and gray colors? Now, that's not fun. So that's kind of how I approached the book too. I didn't have any, you know, like when the girls started reading comics, they were reading like Why the Last Man and Love and Rockets and things like that. Wow. So, you know.
Yeah. And I think the ones I've seen that have maybe worked the best are generally the ones like this, where it doesn't, the goal isn't to write a, maybe that's not the same. It's not like a goal to write an all ages book. It's a goal to write a really good comic book or graphic novel that appeals to the people creating it, with the sense of maybe the people who are reading it. But I think of like, you know, I watch with my kids like Over the Garden Wall, which is a darker show in that sense, but there's things for them there, but it doesn't ever talk down to them. It doesn't ever like humor them in the sense they were kids. And like we've explored like tons of the books, and like, so like they will not, like, this is bad because it is probably why I'm like a bad parent, but like they can't watch Sesame Street and stuff like that, because this is very much a, like, I'm teaching.
Bazinga!
And they're like, I don't want to learn. I swore already.
Like, that's okay.
I don't want to be, like, talked down to or something like that. They pick up on that very well. So, like something where they know either maybe the joke's not for them, or it's something they may pick up or dad gets and I get. Like, there's, like, a whole level of reading comprehension that I think comes just from that, and like that. So something like Sparks, or like he's been reading Hilda as well, is very much that. Like, Hilda tackles like a lot of like, you know, more adult type thing, like moving and kind of experiencing like being an outcast in that, and kind of where that stuff like that. But at the same time, it's filled with like, you know, rock fairies and ogres and stuff like that. And like, it's fun, and like we can both appreciate it on the same level, because at no point does it talk to me while ignoring him, or talking to him while ignoring me. And like, there's a strict balance, which I have to imagine for you guys is really tough to do at the same time.
Yeah. For me, because like I don't really ever deal with kids ever, and I don't really watch or read kids media much. It's not really my thing. I usually go for more YA or adult stuff. So this is totally like not my style of story that I usually tell or draw. And so I was always afraid of like, okay, if I'm working on stuff for kids, how far can I take the imagery? Like, if something is there something like slightly violent going on? Like, how far can I take it before it's too much, you know? Because I don't want to end up offending parents or whatever. Like, that's my biggest concern. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking about like, oh, what kind of kids media do I like then? And Gravity Falls came to mind, because I love that show a lot. And that's on like a Disney Channel. And it's surprising when you watch some of the stuff they allow on the Disney Channel, you know? Stuff they probably wouldn't have allowed like like 10, 15 years ago. Actually, no, the show was probably 10, 15 years old by this point. well, you know, when I was a kid, they had way less violent, not violent, but like, that show gets pretty twisted at times, and it deals with some pretty heavy issues. Yeah, really so...
Because it's, yeah, it's, but it also deals with things like, you know, unrequited love and stuff like that that mm-hmm. aren't necessarily kids' topics. They're really more YA stuff. Like, that show is almost like an all-ages show, Gravity Falls,
yeah.
for sure.
So like, that's the kind of tone I decided I wanted to hit.
Of that, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, like, I took a lot of art style cues from that show as well, because I had to develop a whole new art style for the Spark series, because I usually draw in a more manga style, and Scholastic said they don't want a manga looking style, whatever that means, so I had to come up with something else entirely. So that was kind of tough, but I eventually settled on a style I was comfortable with, which still has a manga influence in there if you look close enough.
Yeah, and the dark sure. stuff is dark. I mean, both of the first two books, and, you know, if there's a third book, there'll be a third book. They all deal with trauma. That's like a big part of mm-hmm. almost everything that I write, because, you know, kids go through things and they get it and they understand it. And so, you know, the first is dealing with basically August's PTSD from being in this lab. And every time that we talk about the lab, things get serious, because this mm-hmm. is where they were abused. And bad things happened at the lab. And I think it's kind of similar to the TV series Kimmy Schmidt to me, where, you know, it was a silly situation, but she was abducted as a kid and taken to this underground bunker, and really bad stuff went down there. And when they talk about the really bad stuff, they do it jokingly, but the event is treated seriously, and the impact is serious, even though the world is kind of crazy at times. And that's similar to what I think try to present with this is, you know, the, you know, there's a talking squirrel and a litter box and what have you, but, you know, when Charlie is worried that people aren't going to love him anymore, it's based on, you know, real fears that I think, like, kids could relate to, and you know, that I can relate to. So, you know, we try to make the dark dark and the funny funny. And one of the differences between doing this and doing, say, an animated series in the first chapter of the first Sparks book, we kill a police officer. And I can't do that on a Saturday morning show.
Yeah.
But Scholastic was fine with it, and we did.
I feel like there were some police disappearances on Gravity Falls, at least.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've seen some people, like, give warnings to other readers in the reviews about the animal testing stuff, in case you're sensitive yeah. to it.
Yep, yeah, it's pretty grim.
And I think, I mean, it's even something we've had, I think it was just today, a discussion. He was talking about Charlie being his favorite, and we were talking about why is Charlie favorite. And one of the things that came up was he's like, I think it's funny that Charlie doesn't like his birthday, because his birthday's coming up, and he's, like, really excited about that. And I was like, well, you know, why? And that's, like, so we had that conversation, and, like, so he went back, he read through, like, here's why Charlie doesn't like it. And like you said, the idea of, you know, as you get older, like, you know, people don't love you anymore. And, like, we have a, let's see, I don't know, 5-day-old in the house now, so he's got, like, a new brother. And, like, that is a concept that he now understands, is able to, like, understand it through Sparks. And that was something that, like, it was just, like, crazy conversation. I was just asking him, like, why you like Charlie. And, like, so, like, these general topics and ideas, like, which were funny to him as he was reading it, when something came up that was relevant to him, he's able to, like, process that through a comic book, which is crazy and, like, awesome. And, like,
yeah, that's great.
That's what I hope is the case. Like, in the first book, August is scared of touching grass, because that's where she was abducted from. She was abducted from the lawn. And so at one point, you know, Charlie is trying to help her out. And the way that I think people would try is like, oh, you're scared of this? Just do it. Just do it. Come on. And when he forces her to, you know, touch grass and get out of the suit and forces her out of the suit, there's consequences to that. That's a big emotional moment for her. And I think the true emotional moments in the book make the funny stuff work better.
Are you guys, because I think in, like, the first one is very, like, August-centric, and especially kind of that and her trauma. And the second one looks a lot at Charlie in that. Are you guys scripting it in that sense? Like, I love that you guys do chapters as well, because I think that paces the book really well in terms of kind of scene moments and also kind of like culmination and moving into the next thing. Is that something you guys early on were like aware of in your world building of like what you wanted to tackle with each character versus like kind of going over the backstory of each in the first one, like in making it like a huge like info dump?
Well, we didn't know we were going to do any more after the first one. The first one was just, you know, that was, we were surprised. And it was a long process before the first one got approved. It went through a lot of testing, lots. And so, you know, we told the story that would be, you know, a complete story to tell. And then we got told that they wanted to do another and possibly another after that. And so, yeah, it did make sense to focus on Charlie for the second one. And you mentioned the chapters thing. we only have chapters in the first book.
Yeah,
because our editor didn't think that was a good idea, and so we tried it out without chapters for the second book, and yeah, but you like the chapters, okay? So we're gonna put that down as a vote for chapters.
I think it's too late to go back now because the third one is not does not have chapters.
No, I can go in and just write chat numbers on each of the chapters.
Yeah, that was an interesting conflict. Because, Ian and I both really like chapters in a book like this, but our editor really didn't like them for some reason.
Well, I think you guys did, and I think what you did, it works, obviously, both, but what was interesting, too, is it had a, I noticed more in the first volume, there was maybe, like, a lot more, full page, splash page type things where, or you guys were able to, like, there was like the classic like whodunit comic moments where you guys like jumped to the next chapter, so there was a lot of like I think room, or it was interesting to see kind of what you guys did and Nina was able to do artistically with those pages prior to like the chapter breaks. I think there was like a lot of dynamic work, I think, like on those pages prior to it.
Yeah,
like, something that you, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I tend to have a more like cinematic style of comicking, which comes from my manga roots, I think. And yeah, like the chapter breaks were great because then it felt like a commercial break in terms of like a cartoon, right? And then when you go back from a commercial break, then you kind of reset everything. You do like you can do like a nice artistic establishing shot and things like that. And yeah, I guess so. A little bit of that was missing from the second book. I think it's still fine. I think it is too late for us to put reintroduce chapter breaks in there, unfortunately. But it's good to know that you like the chapters in the first one.
Yeah, the thing that chapters do is it allows you to move time ahead.
Yeah.
Without saying 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. Though the second book is a little bit different, and I don't mind the chapters not being in that one because there's a growing tension through the whole thing of the new character that's the fake Sparks. And so to give a chapter break might break the tension. And instead, it's just one long continuing story where the tension's getting more and more and more, and everything builds and builds and builds till we get to the climax. So it is kind of playing around with format in a new, you know, in a new world that to me at least. But that is good to know. We might go back to the chapters in the future if we do more books into the far future.
Thinking about it, I wonder if Scholastic. You know, because they publish so many different kinds of books, one of the designations of longer books in elementary school is chapter books. And so I wonder if to them that putting chapters into a graphic novel, you're creating like a problem where, you know, oh, it's a chapter book too? Wait, no, it's a graphic novel. Oh, I just, so they're kind of like, they have this weird kind of resistance to having.
Oh, like they want to categorize it no matter what?
Yeah, so they don't want like a crossover between, you know, like chapter books are this, graphic novels are this, you know. And so
it's an age distinction. That is true. They do group them by age, and chapter books is an older age thing. Yeah.
Because I, literally at this point, to pay for my like purchase of comic books. I pick up hours on the weekend at Barnes & Noble. Like, I have a Monday through Friday 9 to 5, and I work a few hours a week at Barnes & Noble because they give you, like, 40% discounts. So I spend, like, a
bazinga. A little
bit. Oh, wow. Again,
a lot of beeping and everything. But that's something, like, in the like, quote-unquote children's section, there's chapter books, which are, like, I'm trying to think of reference. Like, there's, like, the books called, like, Bad Guys or something like that. So those have, like, illustrated, but they have chapters as well. Mm-hmm. But there are, like, text-heavy ones. And then there are what they consider, like, young adult reader, which are, like, you know, your Harry Potters or, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other ones, which
How
I should
know. Artemis Fowl?
Yeah, so Artemis Fowl.
So popular
like that.
Right now.
Yeah, but, like, it is, like, a weird, because there are some chapter books that I would consider young adult, but because there are, like, heavily chapter-based with, like, some illustrations, they're put there. So I wonder if that is, like, when you're dealing with a company like against Scholastic, which is, like, this powerhouse and not only publishing, but again, now, like, with, like, what they do in the graphic market, I can imagine that's something, like, they weirdly take into account because a store has to put something somewhere and then no one's going to be able to find it because it's some weird place.
Yeah. Corporate groupthink is something that's difficult to overcome sometimes, and I think Nina's discovered that too with some of the color changes they brought to things where they're introducing what I like to call the Rena Telgemeier purple. Because in their minds, what's making the book sell in the design department is this purple color they're using. So they want to, like, put it on everything. And so that way people will be like, oh, this looks like this other book. I guess I'll buy it too, you know. So
do you think that's why they made it purple?
I do think they have an idea that purple is a popular
I should say, like, my
color.
My original colors, they fiddled with my cover art illustration a bit for the second book, and they made a few changes, and one of them was the gray sky. It used to be like a creepy overcast gray sky, and they made it purple. And I'm not the biggest fan of this purple color, but then David just now pointed out, it's like the second book that Reina did. Mm-hmm. Well, which one was that again?
Drama.
Yeah, I think it's Smile, Guts, and Drama.
Well, it was sister. There was Sisters. There was Drama. There was Guts. There was the one with the ghosts. It was called Ghosts, I think.
I'm looking up the cover for Sisters. Right, Guts is purple. Yeah, Drama is also purple.
Yeah, like, that's a lot so of them weird. Have that. They have that, what I call the Rena Telgemeier purple. So I think,
and you know what?
I think that's what they're going for.
Purple is one of my least favorite colors. That's why when I saw this, I was like, oh, I don't want purple.
Well, but it's weird though because Smirk says purple on him. So
exactly. Yeah.
You want a contrasting color.
Exactly. That's why I made it like a bluish gray.
Yeah, I understand. But to them, they want something that stands out on the shelf.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like a bright color is going to stand out
more. It does separate it from the first book too, visually. Mm-hmm. I admit.
Yeah.
And you do.
We're solving a lot of mysteries here today.
we never really sat down and had a long discussion about the book together.
Yeah. Well, I was even because when I saw the cover, like it is almost like a. I was expecting a palette change in the book, and I think there is a palette change, but like not a like. A more, I'm trying to think what like a purple and pink type thing outside of like the space nightmare.
Oh yeah,
like there it is very much
Love
similar
those
to the first one. Yeah, so like it is like when I saw it too, I was thinking it looks like a palette change. I was like, I wonder if this is going to be in like a different setting. But
there is a slight there is a slight difference in the colors between the two books, but that's.
It's very subtle, very, very subtle.
Very subtle, but
and there was
also,
something
also
that was different.
Of...
Yeah, there was something that was different with the tail as well. Is that right?
Okay, don't pry that out. Steve-O's tail had. Why am I talking about this? 2 points at the end in the first book, which I completely forgot about, and I gave him a single point at the end, like a generic tail of a squirrel. I remember now, like I gave him a forked tail. At first, because I wanted to separate his design a bit from other cartoon squirrels, and then I just completely forgot.
But I love that stuff because that's the kind of stuff that, again, if we do this in the far future, I got to come up with the secret origin of what happened to his tail, and like we'll figure it out and we'll give a.
He found a brush. And he brushed it.
And that's the whole story. We'll do this elaborate story, and then the very last page will just be, hey, a brush! Hey, that straightened that out. The end, after a whole bunch of other stuff.
All right, you've got our fourth book.
Yeah, done. Written. This is a good meeting.
Okay. Yeah, it's in the first book that I colored, I put yellow on every page, this same color yellow on every page. No matter what was happening, it always had that one color evident.
Oh, yeah, I remember you telling me about that. Thought that was
and
a nice
I didn't
touch.
Do it in the second book because I wanted to create a different feeling for different parts of the book, so I didn't do that for some elements of it.
It definitely works. I do think the second book feels different because of that very subtle color change.
And what's nice about the color is doing the coloring is you can kind of soften some of the things. Like, so, you know, there's a lot of fire in the second book, but I made the choice to not color it as fire, but to color it slightly differently, so it doesn't feel as threatening. I don't think to kids who are reading it feels more like part of the fun of the story. You're not kind of thinking about it as fire. You just think about it as, oh, they're fighting, but not.
Yeah, you can heighten some things too. Like when you made Evil Spark's teeth all red in one scene, I was like, oh my god,
that was intentional, of course.
Yeah, like, it made him look way creepier than I intended, but
yeah,
I think
he's
it's cool.
Terrifying.
Yeah,
that's kind of the reveal of how evil he is, though.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went that one panel. I wanted him to feel really creepy, and so yeah, making the teeth red, it just kind of created that feeling to me.
I love the coloring in two on the. Sound effects are a lot more dynamic.
Yeah, I like to do that too.
Oh yeah, I really love the work David puts into the sound effects there.
Yeah, there's that one page where Evil Spark shakes. I think it's shakes Steve-O.
Oh yeah, I was just looking at that.
Throws him to the ground and like you had just a single shake, and so I think I doubled it and then put it on the bottom as well, I think is what I did. And then added a bunch of movement lines to it as well with the colors. And it just made it feel way more action and way more like violent.
It works though. It's like visually violent looking, like the lettering.
Yeah.
Lettering is important.
That, right? Yeah. Yeah. Cause you want to have it. And something that you've talked about is that like a manga, the lettering is integrated into the art.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think that's so important.
Yeah,
I can't stand it when in comics it just looks like someone entered a sound effect in a text editor in Photoshop and just called it a day. You know, like it has to be part of the artwork for me. It has to be part of the composition, and the way the sound effects are drawn should really convey like what the sound feels like.
Exactly, and that's why they're colored to represent who's making the sound effect. So if it's Sparks, it's a color. If it's Steve-O, it's a color. It changes depending who's doing the color, doing the sound effects. So it kind of integrates it into the color scheme as well. So.
Well, yeah, and I like, you guys do it in this, and like, I mean, he said specifically in Mango, like, if there is a like crash sound effect, usually the sound effect will denote a crash, but also like the sound effect itself will be often like creating that crash to like emphasize more like the dynamic. Like moment of that, like it's not just like you said, it's not a cut and paste over it. Like it is like so important to that moment that they like integrated in, and it is like physically affecting the world of the comic it's inhabiting.
Yeah, exactly. Like the I think Japanese writing in particular is really good for that, because katakana, which is one of the three styles of Japanese writing, that's what most sound effects are done in, and it's mostly made of straight lines. So you can really play around with that, and like say there's an explosion sound, you can make it look like the lines that make up the characters, the letters, are just like exploding out of the page. And that can be a bit harder to do in English, with the English alphabet.
Yeah, and it depends what you want to do as well, right? So
yeah.
Like I always liked in Asterix and Obelix that their punches, which are, you know, leveling Roman centurions, are just a mere small path. You know, just kind of it indicates the level of effort it takes them to do that. You know?
Right,
and that's fun too. You know, you can the way sound can be used in so many different ways in a comic.
for you guys who, like, again, kind of coming at it from, I think, more evolved and kind of deeper styles and putting it in this, were you working heavily from style guides, not only for, like, I think Nita kind of adjusting your style and being able to reference that a lot, but was there a lot of world building, even with you, Ian, of, like, what would work in this world? I really enjoy and appreciate kind of not only the, like, background characters' interactions with Sparks. I love every time they're like, is that thing meowing? Like,
oh, yeah, I like that running joke, like, too.
Yeah, and so, like, there's, you guys have a pretty clear, like, I feel like, idea of the world, and I think that's where a lot of the humor and moments work. And again, I think for Nita, like, specifically too, I think that's got to be hard, again, if you're adjusting your style so much to inhabit this. Are you guys working with a lot of, I don't want to say documents, but, like, is there, like, a clear, like, kind of character guide, world guide for what you're doing with this?
Definitely not.
Yeah. To a degree, Nina sends me color notes, so
sort of, but
specifically like me to include in.
But it's not like I send you a style guide either.
No, you don't send me a style guide, but because I just had the colors of the main characters to work from, mm-hmm. So that was set, and then from there I could do whatever I wanted. But there's some times where you're kind of like, this is specifically related to something that's going to happen later, so it needs to be this and. Mm-hmm. And stuff. So that's very helpful because I don't always read ahead. I just start calling.
Right.
So
you're like reading it as you're working on it.
I love doing it as I like to experience it as I'm coloring it, because that also colors how I'm approaching it, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. I see what you're saying there. That's nice.
Because there's things I just want to say that something like the lab scene in the first book, you know, it's like one, it's a very grim sequence, so it's basically all one color. The whole thing until it opens up into the outdoor scene, and then it gets colorful again. But it's basically like one or two colors all the way to that sequence. And so, you know, you're intentionally, you know, I'm playing into the oppressiveness of it. And it's kind of the same with the garbage dump scene as well in the second book, where it's a very limited palette of colors, just meant to make it feel like, you know, everything's kind of pressing down on the characters in this moment of crisis. And then when they finally get past it, then the colors come back again and everything gets colorful again.
Yeah, I think you put way more thought into the colors than I ever would, which is why you're the colorist, I guess. And I'm glad that it was handed off to you for that reason. Like, for the flashback sequence in the second book that just came out, mm-hmm. where we see the origins of Charlie, like when he was a kitten and he had an owner who bought him and then... started ignoring him when he got older. For that sequence, I said, like, oh, I just want, like, very limited color palette for this. I want it to feel kind of dreamlike. And then you took it one step further and made it so that all the commodities are painted blue.
Yeah.
And so, like, things that you can buy, like clothes and, like, cat food and Charlie himself are all colored blue.
That's right.
Oh, that's neat.
And that blew my mind. And, like, the phone, too. Like, that's also blue. That totally blew my mind when you put that out.
It's showing what things are important to her. So,
yes.
Yeah. So as Charlie becomes less important, he starts to fade into the background, and other things become the new commodity. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I got to read this book. This is
pretty all right. But I don't think those are things that are, like, you consciously realize, but I think they subconsciously affect when you're reading a story, that you are affected by colors and you're affected by the art and stuff like that. And I think, you know,
I think it's good that we all trust each other too. Like, for example, with the coloring, like, sure, I give like a few notes, but everything else I leave it up to David. And it's not like when he came up with this idea of how to color that sequence, it's not like he came to me going, oh, I was thinking of doing this. What do you think? He just did it. I didn't even know about it until he told me when the book was published. And I'm totally fine with that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Although it was Nina's idea to do the red sequence for the pizza.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was like, I want this whole pizza place to be bathed in red. And you were like, how do I do that? And I said, figure it out.
You're the colorist.
I said, yeah, so you guys have said that's a very scary scene. It's made it actually a very frightening part of the book. Yeah.
Is that the same setup for Ian and Nina, kind of the freedom you guys have with... I mean, laying out a scene in with dialogue, but then kind of Nina having free rein as to, like, visually setting it up.
Oh yeah, she knows what she's doing. We also talk with the last book, the second book, and I don't know, maybe other books. we talk about the plots, and you know, Nina definitely brings her own ideas. There's a character that's in the new book that Nina completely came up with.
Yeah, Potato. I had way more input in the second book, and that was fun. Because, it's not like you had a vague idea of what you wanted for the series, but when it comes, when the time comes to actually hash out the script, then we get together and we kind of bounce ideas off each other, and Potato was a big addition for sure. Potato and the pizza theme, those were my biggest contributions to this book.
Pizza.
Yeah, there was a lot of pizza, and then more pizza, and then even more pizza. It actually worked out well with the... I really wanted to make sure that I got the Charlie being abandoned, because both Charlie and August were based on my real cats, and the Charlie origin story is very similar to the real Charlie's origin story, but I had to adjust it for this kid's book, and the pizza connection was like, oh yeah, that works well with that. And then, you know, it's always fun to do a Chuck E. Cheese kind of riff, especially like my nephew got really hooked on the Five Nights at Freddy's games, and so I was like, oh, okay, this works for that as well. So
that's true, because I was thinking when I first saw the idea, I was thinking, well, do kids even go to places like that much anymore? But then you brought up Five Nights at Freddy's, I'm like, oh yeah, there's still that point of reference. I think Chuck E. Cheese is like bankrupt now, and they're going to close a bunch of places. So we're going to see fewer and fewer of them.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm not laughing at that poor rat losing his job. I don't
poor
know.
Charles Entertainment Cheese.
That's right.
Oh,
they're doing curbside delivery. I get emails for it all the time. It's like, why?
Why would you want food from there without the experience?
There's a rat on the curb handing out pizza. You know, I don't know if that's the best look.
Oh, Ian, did you come up with the idea of Charlie hating birthdays?
It was leading to the abandonment thing, but yes.
Yeah, I think, and then I added that he hates pizza. As a bit of a preview of him hating birthdays. Charlie hates everything. No, I think I really like those elements of the book, because it's like, wow, who doesn't like birthdays or pizza? And I think it's a nice little mystery at the beginning of the book that gets solved later.
And it gets, you know, and something that was definitely an influence were the Pixar movies, something like Up or Ratatouille, but especially Up, that's, you know, there's a movie that does have a lot of silliness in it and action, but it starts with one of the darkest little stories you've ever seen. And kids go to these movies and they're fine. They're fine with it. They get it. You know, WALL-E has like a lot of darkness to it as well. The Incredibles, you know, so many superheroes get murdered. They're just murdered badly, you know, in that thing. And it's fine. It's a kid's movie.
Or killed
movie.
By their capes.
Yeah, or killed by their capes. You know, this is the thing, like whenever I'm, again, writing for a Saturday morning type show, or then they really restrict what you can do. But kids are used to this kind of thing from, you know, the movies that they watch over and over again. And I think that they can handle a balance, and they can handle real emotions, and, you know, just be as funny as possible and be as true as possible. And they'll be good with it, and they'll appreciate it.
And I grew up with a kids manga, which deals with way heavier themes and stuff here. So, like, nothing fazed me as a kid.
When my daughters grew up, they could watch whatever I was watching. So, whatever I was watching was...
Yeah, they were big fans of, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, yeah. Before they were teens, they were fans of... Yeah.
Yeah, my kids, I read when they put out the colorized, like, larger editions of the Dragon Ball Z, me and him would sit and read it. And, yeah, it's maybe because my dad was like, again, he was like, no interest in kid stuff, whatever that means. But like, I think I was three or so, and he told my mom, he's like, I'm going to take him to go see some movie. And then he's like, you like Batman, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm three. I like Batman. He's like, all right, we'll go see 89 Batman. And I was like, okay, all right, that's fine. And so I went and enjoyed it, and that's fine. And like, I don't know. I mean, that stuff is, and again, like my kids, like we just watched, we had to watch a YouTube video today about like him going back to school and like here's all these plexiglass nightmare desks you're going to be sitting in, and it's all because this like virus could kill you, and that's fine, and like you can tell kids other things. If he can understand that, then yes. I'm pretty sure he can understand like a cat who's like has PTSD from being tortured in a laboratory. So
well, yeah, and also just to help kids process these things as well, you know.
Yeah, something that David and I talked about on Sneaky Dragon, plugging my other podcast.
SneakyDragon.com.
Yeah, you can go there. It's a website. But was how Dave would let his daughters watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but you couldn't watch the Disney sitcoms at the time because they were all jerks. And it's something I'm just going to say. I'll throw it over to Dave in a sec. But like I really disliked all those sitcoms because they were all about characters lying to each other, you know, in order to get the thing that they wanted. And then there's, you know, there was some comeuppance, but then by the next episode, they're all just lying to each other again. And that's something that we'll never put into Sparks, or I'll try not to put in my work as well. I found it very cheap and just like such a bad message that, you know, that's like a good thing to do.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in honesty in all things, so I don't like that either. But yes, I found it kind of started because I was painting in the house and I wasn't seeing the television. I was just hearing the voices. And the girls were watching Hannah Montana, and it just started to irk me how much like vitriol and hatred there were in their voices to each other. And they're supposed to be like brothers and sisters. And I was thinking like, and I also didn't let the girls watch Caillou when they're growing up either, because I felt like it created a very negative idea of life. It was all about being fearful rather than approaching things with optimism. And so I just, you know, popped my head up and I said, turn this off. I don't want you to watch this show anymore. So yeah, that became like a rule. They couldn't watch Disney shows for a number of years. I did stop when they were teenagers, though. I just, okay, whatever. But I just think, well, like, when kids are developing, I don't think it's good for them to hear about that you should lie to get what you want, or that you should, that a family should be like a battleground of egos. You know, like that's not healthy, I don't think.
And the insulting humor, I'm not a fan of either.
No,
you know, that's, as you say, that snarkiness, and so again, I try to not have that in these as well.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't want a dog with a blog.
Yes.
Although, yeah, Sparks could do that, I guess.
Yeah. Back when you could just, all you had to do was rhyme a thing, and it was like, that's it. Dog with a blog. I love it. Blue's Clues. Greenlit. Bad Dora. Habit Rabbit.
Dora the Explorer.
Nine seasons. Do it. Bananas in Pajamas. All in. Yeah.
Well, now with the Reina stuff, you have to have the one word. You got to hit them with Sparks and Guts and... There's a few of them I've seen.
Well, you know, what I love is that we have an exclamation mark at the end of our title. I legitimately love that.
Do you really?
I do, yeah. I love it when a title has too, exclamation mark. It just makes it sound fun and exciting.
Yeah, it does.
It's not Sparks, it's Sparks.
Well, it separates you because apparently there is a, like, really crabby-looking comic that came out, I think, in the 90s called Sparks or something.
Oh.
If you Google Sparks.
With no exclamation mark?
No exclamation mark.
So. Yeah, it's been translated into some other languages, including French, and in French it's called Zap. And when I first saw that, I was like, it can't be Zap Comics. That's like that's the R. Crumb comic. Like, you can't call it Zap, but they can, and it's with an exclamation mark, so it makes it, I guess.
It also came out in Hebrew, but I wonder what it's called in Hebrew.
I can't translate it. And Russian. Okay. A couple of things. Mm-hmm.
So before I do the very dad thing and let my kid ask the question, what do you guys, I mean, and again, I think we've talked about this a lot. I think the market is so interesting because one, especially with what's happening with COVID and everything and like, DC laying off a bunch of people because of WB, like the interests are more in, you know, movies and stuff like that. And there's comics itself are extremely weird. There's like a huge market of Kickstarter because people have to essentially like prove that the market's there before anyone will pick up their book. Like it is a weird space, and we do a lot of interviews like with that, a lot of like self-publishing and stuff like that, and where that comes from. And it's like this whole market exists of the young adults, the like, I guess for lack of a better term, like kids graphic novels that are, I think, of quality, if not better. I'm just was reading I think one called The Twins of Montauk and Daughters of Yiss, and they look better than like 50% of the books I read this year from like the big two. Like they're gorgeous books and they're really great. What do you guys like hope readers take away from it, and like what is your idea of kind of what you're, not only what you're, I guess what you're doing with this? Obviously you want to tell a good story and get it out to people, but is it something where like creating something that will open gateways to other readers, not only if it is just reading prose but also exploring other comics? I mean, obviously, like, I mean, you're married to Pia Guerrera, like with like Why the Last, like something epic like Why the Last Man, and getting that in the hands of people. I mean, is that something you guys take into consideration with when you're creating this, or like what do you hope readers kind of take away from it, like with their experience with it?
Okay, is this over to me then?
I think Ian should answer this one.
Yeah. Okay. I would say what I find most encouraging right now, like Dave and I had this conversation again on Sneaky Dragon, our podcast.
SneakyDragon.com.
It feels weird saying a similar thing that I said on the other podcast, but we're talking about the future of comics, and things can look a little depressing. Like I do a book called Exorcisters for Image Comics, yep. And because it looked like stores were not going to be open, basically we had to just go digital this time for the last five issues, which was a bit of a bummer. It's going to be in trade in October, but it was like, oh, that was rough. And at the same time, my wife and I have both been regular cartoonists in Mad Magazine, and we both got, you know, let go from that because, you know, that's all like, you know, shutting down. So it feels like, oh, there's part of the industry that's in trouble. But what I was saying to Dave was I've got great hope for the industry, because the thing is, superheroes can't sustain the industry. And right now, so many different things are coming. It's almost like manga. So many different comics are coming out for young people of so many different styles. And it's making all these kids comics literate, so that when they get a little older, they're going to want something, you know, a little bit different. And they're not necessarily going to want, you know, the next, you know, Spawn or Spider-Man or what have you. In fact, it feels like the best place to see Spider-Man, as much as I love comic books, like superhero comics, is the best Spider-Man I saw was Into the Spider-Verse. Mm-hmm. It's a movie. You know, some of the best, you know, comic book stuff I'm seeing is on TV or film. But there's just such a wide variety of comics. You know, Raina does basically autobiographical comics for the most part. You know, we do our little superhero cats thing, but it's with some dark themes. All these other books are out there, and yeah, when they become teenagers, they're going to want something a little more advanced, and maybe they'll make the next big thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the industry is going to survive because tastes are going to develop, and there's going to be a hunger for a wide variety of things, much in the same way that I believe like manga in Japan, you know, caters to a much wider market than our small little comics industry has been catering to for the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of hope for comics in the future.
Yeah, to expand on that thought about manga, like I'm Japanese, my first language is Japanese, and I grew up with manga. So I grew up reading like a whole bunch of different comics. Like there's so many different kinds out there for kids, drawn by different people. Like there's so many female comic creators in Japan. Mm-hmm. And here it's so different. Like the fact that there's still this stigma against comics for kids is like, it's just crazy to me. I don't understand it as someone who grew up reading so many comics. Like comics are totally fine in Japan. Like they see it as completely fine for kids. They count as real books, and there's so much like educational manga material out there as well. like, you can learn about just about anything in manga format. And I prefer that, too, because I've always had trouble, like, reading prose growing up. So if I wanted to learn something, I'd just read a manga about it. And you don't really have, like, those options here for kids. I mean, it's definitely gotten way, way, way better in the past decade. But things could still be better, I think. And, well, yeah, especially with how it's still a novelty, apparently, that women draw comics here. And, you know, like, I've gotten asked to be on things like panels that are about women in comics, and they ask things like, oh, what is it like being a woman in comics? It's like, I don't know, it's like being a man in comics, but you're a woman? I don't know. Like, it's just so weird to me, like, the North American view of comics here, and, like, I've told the story on Sneaky Dragon as well, but... growing up, always...
What was that? Sneaky Dragon done. That you said? Sneaky Dragon, okay.
I always thought, like, when I was a kid, I thought to be, like, I wanted to grow up drawing comics, but I thought I would have to draw in a manga style and create manga if I wanted to be a female comic artist, because I never saw a female comic artist growing up. Like, all comics, except for, like, newspaper strips, they were all done by men or male-sounding names. So I thought, oh, I guess I better draw manga then, if I wanted to be a comic artist, because women get to draw manga, but women don't get to draw comics. I had this weird notion in my head, and that's based on just the fact that I never saw any female creators. So, like, yeah, like, things are way better now, but could be better, and hopefully having my name out there as a female comics creator for kids, it'll help inspire people. And maybe more parents will grow up open-minded and open to letting their kids read comics, because it's a totally fine medium.
Yeah.
I just want to say real quick, the thing that's so stupid to me about the women in comics thing is, you know, Raina has been on the bestseller New York Times bestseller chart for forever, and, like, her books sell insanely, insanely well. So it feels like, well, that's enough for that. But even, like, as you mentioned, my wife, Pia Guerra, she's a co-creator of Why the Last Man with Brian K. Vaughan, and that was the number one Vertigo book for years, you know, and still she got asked that stupid question. It's like, well, how much success do you have before this question goes away? Because, you know, some of the most successful people in this industry are clearly women, you know, so... we're done with that, right? It's done, you know. And, you know, even with Nina, our book, you know, is like was the number two, you know, Canadian kids book for a couple of weeks there, you know. And, like, yeah, it's done. This question is dumb. It's a dumb question. Stop asking it.
So my next question for Nina was going to be no. No. No, that was, yeah, like, one of, I was...
What's it like being a Canadian? Yeah.
That's good. Stop it. Yeah, I was doing a joint interview with someone because I write for Multiversity Comics as well, and, like, that was something he was typing up, and I was like, again, like, that's not, I think there is an interest in more so, like, what's it like being a woman in comics with, like, kind of what Nina was talking about, where I am a woman in comics, I am successful, like, why do I have to continually answer that question? Or why am I, like, why is, like, Sarah Pacelli, who co-created Miles, like, Morales, not, like, that should be, like, legit, like, that should be, like, legit status in comics forever. Like, it is one of the biggest, like, comic book characters ever. And, like, it's, like, well, it's Brian Bendis, and, like all that stuff is there, but why does that not, like, soak in with the general, like, comics?
Yeah, it's like going up to Beyonce and going, like, what's it like to be a woman in music?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, is it tough being a lady woman in the music thing? It's like, yeah.
But I will say, like, I'm at the bookstore, I'm so interested, like, the manga section is always packed, like, that is filled, and it, mm-hmm. I love that it is filled with a lot of times, like, young women, and then same with the kids, like, graphic novel, like, that is, like, the most packed section, and manga, you can't go down that aisle without running into people, because, like, I don't know, it gets to the point where, like, I mean, you know, you can speak to this more, but, like, you know, in Japan, like, again, that's something, like, you can be on a subway and reading manga, and that's, like, culturally acceptable, mm-hmm. where, like, if you're on a subway in the United States reading manga, they're weird, it's such a weird thing, but...
Yeah, there's manga in everything in Japan. Like, every magazine has a manga section in there. Like, there's businessmen manga, there's, like, recipe manga, there's absolutely everything. I don't understand why there's still such a divide here when it comes to comics as a medium.
Well, it's complicated, but I was thinking it's kind of funny, like, we could say the future is the past, because in the past, in comics, there were all kinds of different comics. There were romance comics, Western, mm-hmm. superhero, crime, horror... There are all kinds of different things that people could read if they, you know, science fiction, obviously, if they wanted to, you know, they could reflect different interests. But yeah, in the 70s, it all narrowed right down to just superheroes. And that became, like, you know, the cliche of comics as well, right? Like, so,
there was a huge romance market, and they were, like, beautifully drawn, like, interesting story. I mean, it's crazy too, because, like, I mean, superhero books are—they're soap operas. Like, they are legit, like, soap operas.
Yeah.
Like, and same with wrestling is like a soap opera, and like, but trying to, like, correlate those two does not happen sometimes in the brains of general comics.
But they're manly soap operas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the difference now is that. Oh, sorry.
So I was just going to say, you can do stuff in the movies you can't do in the comics. You can do stuff like, you can kill a major character, and it's gonna stick, and it has impact in a way that you can't in the comics. As many times as they try to kill a character over and over again, you just get this feeling that it's just looping, and everything's just going to get put back to the way it is, and nothing can advance, and there's just something about that that just makes it feel stale and old. And, like, if you want a good Iron Man story, you're going to go to the movies. You're not going to read it probably in an Iron Man comic anymore. Whereas if you want to read, you know, something like, you know, something that Scholastic does, like Smile, that's the best place to read that. That's as legit. This just feels like this is, you know, the real thing, the actual best source of this.
Mm-hmm. I think the difference now, though, is that, like, in the past, those books were all written by grown men who treated it as a job. It was a 9-to-5 job that they did. And I think it's much more personal now. Like, it's more about the author than it is just about, you know, bread on the table. And, you know, so you know, obviously Raina Telgemeier is an example, but also, like, Lucy Nisley with her new book, Stepping Stones, which is a really great, you know, autobiography book about her growing up as a, living on a farm and working in a farmer's market and stuff. And that's, you know, those are drawn from personal experience and, you know, it's so different than any, you know, what we've ever had before in terms of kid books that kids could read, you know. Like, I didn't, those weren't options for me when I grew up. I mean, the closest would have been maybe Charlie Brown, which is incredibly personal to Charles Schulz, obviously. But everything else you read was just, you know, someone's 9-to-5 job to put bread on the table. They had no personal investment in Richie Rich or Spider-Man or whatever. They're just, you know, writing stories and putting them out there.
Well, I think the way also, I think that, I mean, I don't know how it is with, obviously, like, Scholastic or that sense, but, like, and even with, like, Ian with Image, like, so you put out a book, you're to create your own book, and Image will do press for that book, but it is limited. With comics nowadays, like, you are the press person, like, you are pushing, you have to push yourself all day, all day, every day, these are my books, like, does anyone want to set up interviews? Does anyone want, like, review copies? And it's just, like, I mean, I've talked to, like, so many people where, like, you know, I don't have a book coming out I'm working on, like, 3 books. They're not dropping for a year, but, like, I have to keep posting art every day or my, like, Twitter follows will drop. And if that happens, Diamond will request my numbers and they won't distribute the book. Like it's insane, like, the amount of stuff. So, like you said, going from, like, it being a 9-to-5 to literally, like, it is, like, people's, like, livelihood and investment and personal, like, stake in kind of the stories they tell and how these stories are getting out to the people who want to read them.
Well, it's also different in the way that like it, I think there's also a difference between mainstream comics. Okay, Scholastic books are really the real mainstream comics, yeah. But something like a Marvel and DC book, you know, first of all, they're written by fans for the most part, people who grew up with this. And something written by fans is different than someone who's writing something just as a job. There's that. Mm. But I think something that's different now is, so you write your comic and it goes out there, and this, and the day that it's released, if not earlier, everyone lets you know immediately what they think about it. It's there. It's just like, you know, all the message boards are lit up, and there's the strength. There's an interaction, and you're expected to interact in a certain way, you know, that's like, whoa, you know. Whereas I think with a kid's book like Sparks, it's still the old traditional route of it's out there, and Nina and I are not going to be talking online, two kids writing to us about this. It's like, no, you take it and you talk about it and you discuss it and you know, do what you're going to do with it. Whereas there's a real intense interactivity, and the success must be instantaneous or it's a crushing failure, and opinions are so harsh, pro and con, and it just makes it, it's just so tense. And, you know, it's just nice to be able to write a story and then just go, hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, no 10-year-olds tweeting at you that your book's garbage, you SJW.
No, there's still Goodreads, but it's been pretty okay. I got a bum review a while back, and Dave has heard me read it out loud many times.
It's become his performance piece. He's going to do a one-man show based around it.
Yeah.
My Bad Review by Ian Boothby.
I couldn't be more disappointed. It seems like it's not written by the same person. Oh, what a shame. I loved it so much, and it just let me down. It's like, thank you, voice in my head, that somehow was able to write a review.
There you go. Just a taste.
But the rest seemed very nice. The feedback has been very nice.
Yeah.
You've got
the most important feedback, which is...
You've got to hunt it out, you know, feedback, really, on that kind of stuff.
The most important feedback are all the pictures of kids reading it or hearing about kids who have grabbed it out of their parents' hands and locked themselves in their room out of sight to eat it up. So that's what really is the important thing, I think.
This is a good segue. Normally my co-host Tim would ask his final question, but I won't. So I will let my... I have three quick questions from my oldest, and he is 6. His name's Winter.
Aww.
5. His name Fox. So,
okay,
all right. That's great. And by the way, thank you for honoring our request to not have Tim be on this show. We all asked you that, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It comes up a lot. I was happy to do it. All right. Hopefully, I did this. I'd practice it before.
How do you color in the book? Is it like a coloring book?
I think that's for David.
It is very much like a coloring book. When I get the pages from Nina, they're black and white. So I have the outlines of the characters. They're all been inked by Nina, and so I just fill in, just like you would in a coloring book. But I have to be really careful to not color outside the lines. I fill in all the white spaces and make them all into colors. And even the white in the book isn't exactly white. If you took a piece of actual white paper and compared it, you'd see that it's more like a blue color. So everything's been colored, just like in a coloring book.
Yeah. So you can definitely tell he's my kid, where I was like, all right, come up with questions. And his first question was for the colorist. I was like, nobody asked the colorist questions.
I'm delighted that the first question for the colorist. That's great.
Yeah,
that was great. You do know all in Photoshop, right?
I just want to say one thing is, if adults ask that question and they go, do you color on the computer? And I go, oh yeah, I color on the computer. Their faces immediately get like the most disinterested look, as if I just told them that I have a robot color it for me.
Yeah. Well,
like, I'm still coloring it. Like, I'm still...
It's like how people look down on digital art in general. They're like, oh, you do everything with computers. Well, that makes it easier. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It's just another tool.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really funny.
Because you're still flatting everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Flatting is the coloring. I don't really add too much more to it. So there you go.
That's true, yeah. I mean, you do add some shading here and there.
A little bit, but yeah, I'm really not a...
But it's not like you have a button that you click and it fills in all of Sparks and all of August and Charlie.
That's right. Yeah, that's how people react, though. As soon as you tell them you color it on a computer, they're just like, huh, well, I guess...
Siri, color book.
I guess some people have it easy.
Dave.
Well, they're just yeah. they're just ignorant. It's like when people think inkers just trace the pencils well, and call it a day.
Well, that's even worse when you call them ignorant. They get really upset.
Well, I guess that's a good way, a good segue again to his second question.
All right.
What do you use to draw the book?
Well,
because we've discussed a lot about that and digital versus is and. Pen and paper, and explaining like you said, there's the misconception of like if you can just draw on digital, like it will just draw it. And like you still have to have the skill and technique to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. This doesn't draw it for you. So yeah, he wanted to know how you were, what medium you were using for it.
Yeah, the computer just makes it faster and easier sometimes to do certain things. Like, okay, so for a long time, when I worked on Bongo Comics, I was drawing directly on paper and sending in the pages through FedEx. And after a certain point, I switched to all digital. That's when I found out I could do it digitally. I wish they had told me sooner. Then, like say if I drew an entire panel and then I got back a note saying, oh, can you shift the entire Simpsons family down half an inch? On paper, I would have to erase everything and then redraw the entire thing. Just to shift it down half an inch. But on the computer, I just take the marquee tool and just kind of nudge them down. And that's it. So that's how it makes it easier. It's not like I'm, like I said, clicking a button that draws in all the Sparks lines or anything like that. Yeah. I do it in Clip Studio Paint because that has the best lines in it. I used to draw in Photoshop, but yeah, the line work is just way smoother in Clip Studio Paint. And Photoshop is more for like photo editing. Clip Studio is definitely for comicers. However, I don't really take advantage of all the tools in Clip Studio. I just use it for, like I said, the nice brushes. I don't use any of like the panel border tools or speech balloon tools. I think there's like tone brushes I could use if I wanted. So instead of like hatching in a bunch of little lines, I could take a brush that has hatch lines and use that if I wanted to. But I don't. Part of it is because I don't know how to use some of those tools. Another part is I just like it when things look hand-drawn. So even though I'm drawing digitally, I use a Cintiq. So I'm just, it's like a giant monitor that I apply a stylus to, and I can draw directly on the monitor. And I like to hand-draw all the panel borders. I like to hand-draw all the speech bubbles. It just looks better that way, I think. And if I had the time and the patience, I would hand letter everything too. But instead, I made a font that looks like my handwriting, I'm glad my editor talked me into doing that instead of hand lettering everything, because that would take forever. Oh my god. Yeah. Or hire a letter, I guess, but I'd rather it be my own handwriting. I just like things to look organic. So everything I draw, it's exactly how I would draw it on paper with natural inks. It just happens to be on a monitor with Clip Studio.
I was going to say something. Oh, yeah, I do it in Photoshop. I've heard that you can color in Clip Studio, which I also have Clip Studio. I could, but I know Photoshop because forever I've, when we first started doing Sneaky Dragon, I decided it would be fun to do like an image for every episode. And so I had to start learning how to color and start learning how to use Photoshop. And so one thing I found with Clip Studio is there's not that many tutorials online to help you, to give you little tips, you know, like if you want to do a fog in Photoshop, you just type in, how do you do fog in Photoshop? And then there's someone who has a tutorial.
Mm. Well, Clip Studio is like way more new of a program, whereas Photoshop has been around for forever.
Yeah.
Clip Studio is, it used to be called Manga Studio, and it became Clip Studio to, I guess, make it more inclusive to other styles. But it's not great for coloring, I gotta say. Like there are certain tools that make it easy to flat things, like the wizard tool. You can make it so that it closes in the gaps. Yeah, and you can say, okay, if there's a gap that's like only 3 pixels wide, just fill it in. Like that makes it easier to flat. But it doesn't handle CMYK colors. That's my biggest problem with Clip Studio.
Yeah.
For the Sneaky Dragon, you're doing all the title cards for those?
I did for several years. I think I got up to around 200 and something of them, and then
Jesus.
I had to stop because I started coloring Sparks.
Yep.
I just couldn't, because I work a full-time job as well, so I have a 9-hour day of work, and then I have my commute as part of, and on top of that, plus I have a family and other
that's
interests.
Secondary, that's not interesting.
But because you worked on those title cards, we hired you to color, pretty much.
Sure, yeah.
Because we knew you could do it, and you knew how to use Photoshop.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have definitely learned over time, because like I say, what's nice is whatever problem you have, you can turn to YouTube, and there's someone there who's, here's how you do this, mm-hmm. you know? So when you suggested I do that, what is it called? Attack of Titans or something? Attack of the Titans?
Attack on Titan.
Attack on Titan, that's right. You suggested I do that as a title card one time, and it needed a fog along the bottom of it. That's where I had to look up how to do a fog for Photoshop. And they said, this is how you do it. And I'm like, that's great. Mm. Thanks, guys. Thanks, YouTubers.
All right. And this last one is for Ian, and it's the least interesting. But he's 5, so I'll let it slide.
Why is a Litterbox a robot?
He wants to know why the Litterbox is a robot.
Because if it wasn't a robot and it was a regular Litterbox, it wouldn't talk. And he's the one who tells the... Well, I say he, sorry. Not they don't have a gender. They're the one that tells the story. So if they were a litter box that didn't talk, no one would tell the story, and then there wouldn't be a story.
Exactly.
So there's that. But the other reason is, because I think it's funny to have a talking litter box. I thought that would be a funny narrator, and I've never seen a story told by a litter box.
Also, it would be more horrific if the litter box was an organic creature that was also a litter box.
Well, I would have to see that drawn first, Nina. So
okay, fourth book.
Do up a couple of samples. And by the way, those samples will just be... you won't have to draw those a million times in the future if you do that. Just please. It's really simple. Just if you could do that, that'd be great.
That would be a good... I mean, you guys might have introduced a new generation to... Cronenberg.
Dead Ringers connection is very it's deeply ingrained into
fourth book for sure. Fourth book, litter box becomes living and organic, and Steve-O finds a brush
that's
and then Steve-O brushes organic litter box's fur. It's gonna be furry as well.
Oh, so now we're going to have an existence type of thing where the brush can get plugged in a way. But I don't want to spoil too much for you.
Please, you're spoiling it already.
Well, you know, the story has to grow up with the readers. So, you know, as our readers get older, we need to appeal to more mature tastes.
You can do like a Videodrome where there's like a litter box in someone's stomach.
The final book will be full on Ito.
So, for anyone who wanted to, I guess, find out more about your stuff, what would be the best way to do it? Apparently, you guys have a podcast. I'm not sure. I don't know if we've mentioned.
First I've heard of it.
I'll go first. I'm the one who doesn't have a podcast, but does guest on podcasts a lot. I'm Space Coyotl on Twitter. That's Space Coyote with an L at the end instead of an E. Go to spacecoyote.com to see more of my work, and sparkscomic.com if you want to learn more about Sparks. If you go to the bottom, you'll see a link to our merch store. You can buy t-shirts and mugs and stickers and face masks, too, because we're in that era right now. That's about it.
And sneakydragon.com is the name of our podcast, which is a mature podcast. But immature in that kind of way that probably Dave would have let his daughters listen to it when they were little. Not in a mean way. There's also we have a bunch of other podcasts we've done that are on there from the past, where we went through all the Marx Brothers movies, all the Tintin books, and all the Beatles albums. Yep. Those are all there for free. And we've got two new podcasts that we're doing, one called Fansplainers, where we go through movies and talk about them. And what's the other one, Dave? The
other one's called Sneaky Dragon Listening Party, which is a podcast I do with my daughter, where we listen to music and talk about the history of music.
Oh, nice. Yes. It's so easy once you do one. You're like, well, I could just do another. And then you're like,
I know. My wife wants to start one called Horse Mysteries, so that's next on the list.
Obviously, the most important thing is go pick up Sparks 1 and 2 out now, pretty much, I think, in every major bookstore, online. I will say, Exorcist Sisters. I know Volume 1 is out. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you.
And then all of Nina's art and shirts are amazing. I read, was it Islands?
Oh, yeah, that was part of an anthology collection, New World.
Which is great looking.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've done a few story contributions to anthologies here and there. Lately, I haven't had time to do that because I'm so busy working on Sparks. I'm working on Sparks 3 right now.
And further, I always hate doing our stuff at the end because, again, like, podcasts are one thing, comic book podcasts, like, no one just randomly stumbles on a comic book podcast because, like, that's not of interest to a majority of people. But we're at pages_panels, and we do another weekly show, The Greatest Comic Book of All Time, where we pick what we felt the greatest book of all time that we read that week was, and we talk about it, new and old. And then we have a new, we're going to try it this month, a live stream of a comic book club or some, I don't know. I'm not good at the promoting stuff, but again, it's comic books. You probably know where to find it. But again, the most important thing is going out and picking up Sparks. Again, I can't thank you guys enough for coming on. And like I said, I've read through it. I read through it because of him. He picked it up. We've read through it. I've read through it. I think if he hadn't, I still would have read through it and enjoyed it. I think it's fantastic what you guys have done with this book, and I look forward to the third one.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is this issue of Pages and Panels. Next time, Tim will be back, and we will definitely get to talk about it.
Bazinga. Bazinga. Eigen ist